This is Letters in Politics. I'm Mitch Jezrich. When we say information highway, people today will think of the internet. But when we say information highway of antiquity, well, we could probably think of the Silk Road, the network of routes making up the Silk Road united West, Central, and East Asia, and it stretched all the way to the Mediterranean world and beyond. The Silk Road was responsible for the spread of writing, papermaking, coinage, and ideas. Buddhism traveled from India to China, and Islam moved east on it as well. Trade on the road helped the development of civilizations in China, India, Persia, Europe, and Arabia. My guest, Valerie Hansen, has explored the ancient documents that have been found throughout the Silk Road. Ancient documents like contracts, receipts, medical prescriptions, and business records. Documents, some of them in ancient language, if not all of them, many of which are dead today. Valerie Hansen is a professor of history at Yale University, and she's author of the book, The Silk Road, A New History. Valerie Hansen, it's a pleasure to welcome you to the show.
Thank you for having me.
All right. Can you give me a more precise geographic explanation of where the Silk Road is, more precise than I just sort of outlined?
Well, I was going to say the Silk Road consists of all the routes linking Europe with Asia. So some of the routes are overland through Central Asia. One of my friends, who I often quote in this book, said to me, we should stop saying the Silk Road and we should just say overland Central Asian routes. So there are the overland Central Asian routes, and then there are also the sea routes. And some of
there are sea routes that make up the Silk Road as well.
Right. And they were certainly in use very early on. There's one Chinese pilgrim who writes about sailing from India to China in the year 400.
Mm-hmm.
And he gets blown, of course, and ends up thousands of miles from where he expects to be.
How old is this network of roads? And I guess some roads would be older than others.
I think when we live in America and we think about somebody crossing the Himalayan mountains, we think, oh, this is an insurmountable obstacle. When could people have done this? But when people go and talk to the people who live there, they always find out about different roads and lots of different roads. And I remember once hearing someone, a Japanese woman, who'd talk to people about the route over the Himalayas. And the local people said to her, oh, well, there's this route. We go in the summer. This route is for the winter. This route is the route for pregnant women.
Oh. Was that the easy one,
and the one that was pretty flat. So anyway, I was going to say this book is, I focus on excavated documents.
Yeah.
So I don't pretend to cover every single place on the Silk Road.
Sure. But let me just talk a little bit more about what the Silk Road is, and I want to dive into the documents that you talk about in your book. It wasn't known as the Silk Road.
No, nobody ever used that word before 1877.
Yeah. Tell me about the naming of it.
Oh, it's named by the German geographer von Richthofen. He's the great uncle of the World War I ace.
Mm-hmm.
And he puts this label on a map. He makes an incredibly comprehensive atlas of China. And one of the maps has this word, the Silk Road.
The Silk Road.
On it.
And why did he name it the Silk Road?
I think because he had a classical education and he had read Pliny. Pliny the Elder rants against the Roman imports of silk. And so I think it was kind of a convenient name. I don't really know the answer.
Silk was traded on the route, but it wasn't like the only thing, or perhaps even the most abundant.
Well, in 1877, when von Richthofen coins that name, he doesn't know what was traded.
Yeah.
He's just shooting in the dark.
He's
making a map. He's interested in railroad lines, and that's one of the reasons I think that he draws it as basically a single line connecting Rome with China.
And so when he drew it, it was a single line.
Yeah, basically a single line with a few detours.
Uh-huh. Is that still how we recognize it today, or?
No, nowadays when people draw it, they're usually two or three routes. They all go out of China from modern Xi'an, so in northwest China, through Gansu province. I'm telling you places that you may not know where they are. Xinjiang, which is an autonomous region where there's been a lot of unrest.
Yeah.
There's the Taklamakan Desert, and there's the northern route around the Taklamakan and the southern route. And then from there, west to Samarkand, and then from Samarkand, west to Syria.
And Samarkand, that's an important
Very important city.
Tell me about that.
Well, it's the main traders that have left us written records are called the Sogdians, and they spoke a language called Sogdian. It's related to Middle Persian, and they were all from around Samarkand. So the Silk Road, when you look closely at the documents, the Silk Road, nobody traveled all the way from Rome to China, but people did go between Samarkand and Chang'an. That was a major artery.
That was a major artery. Talk to me about the documents you studied.
Chinese historians have the luxury of a very long transmitted record, and we have the first dynastic histories from the first century B.C. up until 1911. What's new is that we also have archaeologically excavated documents, and that's what this book is about. And these are found sometimes in deliberate caches that are buried and people know they're going to come back to them, a kind of archive, but also sometimes in garbage where somebody throws away a contract that no longer has any value. People recycled paper. Paper was invented in China in the 2nd century BC, and it's the secret of making paper is moving out through Central Asia all through the first millennium, but it's expensive. And so people recycle it. They make clothes for the dead. There's one silver site called Turfan, where a lot of the documents we have were cut into shoe soles, and you can see the needle marks on the shoe soles from the contracts that were recycled to make the shoe soles. There's about 2,000 Turfan documents, and maybe 300 are contracts. So contracts were very important form of document that people used, and we would never have known that without these excavated documents. There's no hint in the transmitted sources about that. And then I was going to say there are things like an abandoned mailbag that has 8 letters in it that happened to be in Sogdian, in this language spoken by the people from Samarkand.
So you were saying that clothes would be made for the dead. So the dead might be wearing...
The dead are buried in...
And business contracts and...
Exactly. And then the trick is they're excavated and archaeologists piece together these original documents out of the shoe soles. Or there's one in Turfan, there's one paper mache coffin made entirely out of receipts for horse feed for the horses in the employ of the Chinese troops that are stationed there.
Your book begins with the ancient lost city of Nia.
Right.
Am I pronouncing that correct? And I should say that before we began this conversation, you said we don't even know how some of these are
actually
pronounced.
Yeah, I'm not going to correct you.
Why Nia? Tell me about the ancient lost city, you call it.
Well, it's a city that was really discovered around 1900. Nia was discovered by Orl Stein, who was a naturalized Hungarian who worked for the government of India as an archaeologist and explorer. And Stein went there because he was working his way along the southern Silk Road. So he crossed into Xinjiang, actually the same way that the ancient travelers did. He was in northeastern India and crossed through certain passes and gets to what's Kashgar and then starts working his way south. And as he travels, one of the men working for him hears a rumor that they've discovered pieces of wood with writing on them in Nia. So he goes to Nia, and one of his men buys a document. And I have a picture of that in the book. So Stein goes to Nia, and he finds it's in the sand. There was originally a river that ran through the village, and it had shifted course. So there's the last settlement is about 100 miles south of where the actual archaeological site is. And Stein goes to the archaeological site, finds the houses, and then starts digging in the sand. He's hired a bunch of maybe 20, 30 workmen. And at Nia, he finds wooden documents that have a script on them. This is so confusing. It's a script called Kharoshti. It's the name of a script. And it's used to write a spoken form of Sanskrit, usually called Pali. But in this case, we know where they spoke it. The language is called Gandhari, which was spoken in Gandhara, which is in modern Afghanistan and Pakistan. And those documents turn out to be letters from the king telling local officials what to do, legal agreements. There's some police reports. 2 people come in and list all the goods that have been stolen from them. They may be merchants. There's very little mention of any trade in this village. And I start there because you can see people of different cultures interacting and learning from each other. You have a group of people who have come from India. They're speaking Gandhari, and they're Buddhist.
Yeah.
They teach the people who are living in this village about Buddhism, and they teach them how to write on, there's no paper yet, to write on wood.
So there was no paper yet then?
There's paper in China, but it hasn't yet reached this place yet.
But it was coming.
It was coming.
Yeah, from China.
Yeah, it'll arrive around 400.
Yeah, in 400. Along with the compass?
The compass is different, and the compass is coming out of China, too. But the compass is not moving through Central Asia, right? The compass is just on the sea route.
Uh-huh. Well, where you really need it.
Yes.
I suppose.
Well, I was going to say the compass floats. The Chinese compass floats in water, and they made in needle. It's true. You're right, but none of these Silk Road travelers has a compass.
Yeah.
It's interesting. You think about it. It would be such a great thing for them to have. But no, I think they're almost always hiring guides who take them from one place to the next place.
Well, when we think of the Silk Road and all the trade that occurred, was it equally moving in both directions, or did most of it come from China towards Central and West Asia, or was it?
I'm very skeptical about the extent of Silk Road trade.
Yeah.
I think a lot of the trade, at least as it's recorded in these documents, is local.
Mm-hmm.
And the merchants are not covering huge distances. It varies in different periods. But there's one merchant who we know is on a circuit that's just about 100 miles. And he keeps moving it. He's traveling in the 10th century, and there's no coins. So he's basically bartering undyed cloths for dyed cloths. He goes to different households and they give him dyed cloths at a ratio of 3-2. Mm-hmm. So a lot of the information you can see about the merchants is one or two people, a couple of animals, not always camels, sometimes horses and donkeys, and they're moving, and often they're selling locally made goods.
Mm-hmm. Again, we are in conversation with Valerie Hansen. She's a professor of history at Yale University, and we're talking about her new book, The Silk Road, A New History. Why do you call it a new history?
Everybody asks that. Because I'm arguing that the Silk Road exchanges, that many of the people moving on the Silk Road were not merchants.
People were
moving.
So who was moving?
So the different groups of people, often refugees, people fleeing their homelands that are war-torn. There are missionaries and pilgrims. So missionaries who are seeking to teach their religions, pilgrims who are hoping to learn from teachers. There are artists. There are craftsmen, like metal workers, we know are moving from Central Asia into China. There are soldiers. And there are some merchants. All of these people may engage in trade. There are also envoys that this government send from one ruler will send envoys to another ruler to bring him gifts ostensibly, but also to spy on his court. And so all of these people may engage in trade, like the envoys carry some goods that they are privately trading on the side. But their primary purpose in moving is not necessarily to trade. So that's why it's a new history.
And a lot of languages.
A lot of languages.
Tell me about the languages of the Silk Road.
Well, there were certain lingua franca that people are speaking. So Chinese is not, in this early period in Nia, there's not that much evidence of Chinese. Sanskrit, because of Buddhism, people are speaking Sanskrit in the monasteries. The language that traders use, but they're not only traders, is the Sogdian, this language related to Middle Persian. And we know about Sogdian because of an abandoned mailbag with 8 letters in it written in Sogdian. And that's not the earliest Sogdian materials we have, but those are the most detailed accounts we have that early on, and some of them are about trade, and actually somebody in China writing to somebody in Samarkand about, well, I was going to say a coup, an overthrow, a new ruler. But there are also things like a woman who writes to her husband, and he's complaining that he's abandoned her. She hasn't heard from him, and she says that her mother told her not to come with her husband, and she disregarded her mother's instructions, and she really wishes that she hadn't, and she wished that she would rather be married to a pig or a cow than to this guy.
That was her.
That's her response.
Some of us have heard that before. But you were mentioning the mail bag. Ancient Persia developed the postal system, didn't it?
That's interesting. It has the postal road. Herodotus writes about this, the people carrying messages for the government. But these letters in these Sogdian letters are probably being carried by a private carrier. Not all of them. There are some envelopes that survive, and some of them are addressed, but very casually. So it seems like it's someone who's going to visit people he knows. That's what most people think about those.
And that happened a lot along the Silk Road.
Yeah, and that's not so. It's kind of between Lolan and Dunhuang, and Stein is, there's a tower a watchtower, and he starts digging in it, and he gets bored and leaves his men there. And then when he comes back, they show him these letters. And Stein has an incredible education, and he recognizes Karoshti. He also recognizes these scripts. He doesn't know it's Sogdian. Nobody knows it's Sogdian. It's a new language. But he thinks it looks like Aramaic. He's smart enough to know.
Is it related to Aramaic? Uh-huh. So they have a common ancestor language?
I think Aramaic is the ancestor of, the earliest Sogdian has certain words that are copied entirely in Aramaic, the phrases. So Sogdian is a direct descendant of Aramaic.
In the writing, is it an alphabet?
It is an alphabet.
Phoenician or related to a Phoenician alphabet?
Yeah, everything is related to the Phoenician alphabet.
All the alphabets are. Excuse me.
So yeah, it's some of the letters are related.
Yeah. Well, just to say, our the alphabets go back to the Phoenicians.
Right. At least these European alphabets, right?
Well, what about
the
Arabic?
Korean alphabet is, Arabic too, but I was just thinking about the Korean alphabet, for example, is one of the world's alphabets. Hangul is not related to Arabic.
Oh, interesting.
Right,
interesting.
It really develops independently.
Uh-huh. Well, that's interesting, and very different than say, Chinese.
Oh, yeah, because it's an alphabet.
Yeah.
So, Hangul is, I have only studied it on airplanes, so I don't know it. But if you, it doesn't take that long to learn.
I don't mean to get us too off track here, but this developed independent of the other alphabets.
When people are dealing with the Chinese characters, which are so difficult, often they notice that there are certain things that sound the same. And what the Japanese did, and they developed their two different systems of phonetic systems for writing Chinese, was they just picked one word that sounded one way, and any time they heard that sound, they used that word. So now the Korean one is, the Japanese kana, the two systems of kana, are related to those words that they chose, mostly on the basis of frequency. Korea is completely different. It's an entirely artificial system designed to show the sounds of letters. So like B and P, those two sounds look very similar.
Yeah.
Because the guy who designed it, and this is around 1500, is credited to a king. I'm not sure the king really did this, but anyway. I should say that many Koreans would probably attack you. But anyways, Koreans say it's the best alphabet in the world because it captures sounds in that way.
That's very interesting. Yeah, I didn't realize that about the Korean alphabet. You again dived into, I guess, countless documents. Must seem like countless documents, or are there countless documents? Maybe.
I was going to say, for each of these sites, there's not that many, a couple of thousand. And when we say that, many of them are fragmentary. I was once part of a project cataloging the Turfan documents, and we only put the documents in that we thought any historian could use. Mm-hmm. So we rejected probably three quarters of what we looked at. The only place where there are countless documents is Dunhuang, where there are a cave repository where there were about more than 40,000. The estimate is 40,000, 20,000 in Chinese, 20,000 in Tibetan, and then these other languages too, including Sogdian, including Hebrew.
Uh-huh.
There's a fragment of Psalms that's written in Hebrew.
In Hebrew. And as you went through these documents, you didn't speak all that. Many of the languages aren't spoken today.
Many of these languages are not spoken today. And I was going to say, I don't read many of these languages. Yeah. This book rests very heavily on the work of colleagues who know and have deciphered those languages.
Yeah, and you were telling me before we began, there's 20 people?
Well, it depends.
There.
Like Sogdian, I don't know how many people actually read and write Sogdian, but I would say for people who publish articles and then can disagree about what something means, there might be 4 or 5.
The Silk Road, does it exist today? Not so
clear? That's a good question. I don't think so. I think the Silk Road it's best to think of it as existing in the first millennium, so from the year 1 to the year 1000, and linked with Buddhism and all those political events. In right around 1006, Khotan is conquered by an Islamic army. And really, there's a huge sea change. The sources change. We know much less about, there's much less material about, generated basically by people writing Arabic than there is by people writing Chinese and these other languages. And the whole region, the orientation shifts. Mm-hmm. So people are focused really on the Islamic world and not on China any longer. And I think the patterns of local trade continue, but when travelers come in those later periods, they visit these different kingdoms, and they're no longer describing a world where people know a lot about other places. These have become very insular places.
What changed?
one of the things that's very striking about the Silk Road is that it's an era of great tolerance. The individual rulers have whatever religion they have, many often Buddhist, but they're not forcing their subjects to be Buddhists, and they're allowing their, especially communities of foreign peoples, to continue to worship whatever religion it is that they bring with them from their homeland. And that doesn't change immediately, but eventually Xinjiang becomes entirely Islamic. So I think that we see much less of that tolerance than we saw in that earlier period.
Talk to me a little bit more about Buddhism spread from India to China, and perhaps we could talk about one of the great translators of this in Sanskrit into Chinese, and that was Kumar Rajiva.
Right. It's funny. Yes, he is one of the great translators. He was born in a city called Kucha in Chinese, Kucha in Uyghur, and it's on the Northern Silk Road. His mother, let me get this right, his mother was local, so I think, and his father was from India. And I think his mother was a local princess. And he actually traveled to India. And so he grew up very conversant. His native language was Tocharian, mm-hmm. which is an Indo-European language. There are two versions of it, but his native language was Kuchayan, and he studied Sanskrit. And then when he's in his, he's around 50, he's kidnapped and taken to a Chinese city, and he creates the first translation bureau where there are, well, people working in teams to translate. And the previous pattern would simply be to have somebody read a text or recite, often from memory, a Buddhist text in Sanskrit, and then the teacher would try to explain it, and then someone who knew Chinese would try to write it down. So there was a lot of mistakes. And Kumar Ajiva's great contribution is to systematize the translation. And the translations that he produces, his bureau produces, are still very popular. People find them very accessible.
They still read them.
They still read them. But interesting thing about Buddhism is, of course, Buddhism comes from India into China. But it's also, it's not just the religion, it's how to deal with information in a foreign language. And so the Chinese before this have no experience recording words in a foreign language. And they transcribe Sanskrit sounds into Chinese characters. Can't use an alphabet, there is no alphabet, right? But they do the same thing I was talking about before. They pick certain sounds and they always often represent them with those characters. And so they transliterate into Chinese characters. One estimate is that 35,000 new words come into Chinese, and some of them are Buddhist words, like the word for wisdom. But some of them are very common words, like moment. And the Chinese discover they have a tonal language. They haven't, I mean, they've known when they write poems, they know that words have certain sounds and they vary, but they don't realize to an outsider that they have a tonal language. And one of the very cool things about the Silk Road documents is that some of them are phrase books. They're lists of phrases in different languages. So you can see people trying to learn each other's languages. And that, I think, is something new, this process of language learning.
How influential then was Kumar Rajiva in spreading Buddhism to China?
He makes the first translations that make any sense to the earlier translations. You had to know Buddhism or maybe even know Sanskrit to make heads or tails of. Yeah. With his translations, you could just come to them, read as a native speaker of Chinese, and they made sense. So he is very influential. And that's when Buddhism first comes in, there's the Chinese, especially the Confucians, look down on Buddhism because there are Confucian texts, but there's nothing like that. There's no comparable library of Buddhist texts. And one of the things that the Buddhist missionaries need is written texts that can rival the Confucian and Taoist texts.
Contrast that for me with the spread of Islam on the Silk Road.
Well, first of all, I know a lot less about it. Often the pattern in Islam is that the ruler converts and the five pillars are key. And we have records of people going, some people going on the Hajj, but not that many. That's one of the things that people notice in like the 17th and 18th centuries when they go to Xinjiang, is how few people have been out of these kingdoms and gone on the Hajj. I mean, of course, people are studying the Quran, but not there's not the same group of texts that you have with the Buddhist text. There's, I mean, the Buddhist canon is a wall full of books. There's nothing, mm-hmm. there's nothing that's like the Bible or the Quran in Buddhism. Mm-hmm. There's a whole host of
different texts. Right, right. Not one book. But a multiple of books.
Right.
Yeah. But with Islam, were there also translators translating Arabic into...
Well, you... Not initially, right? Mm-hmm. Everyone was supposed to learn Arabic. And even in the 19th century, Chinese Muslims are studying Arabic. There's I'm pretty sure that you're not supposed to translate the Quran. There's some kind of injunction. And so now that we have modern translations, but I think historically everybody always studies the Quran.
There's a spread of Arabic in the language as well.
Right, but people... many visitors in the 19th century comment on how little Arabic people in China know.
Yeah. Yeah. We'll say, for example, modern-day Uyghurs.
Mm-hmm.
A connection to the spread of Islam on the Silk Road?
Sure, because that's their religion, and that's where it's from. It's funny, there's two groups of Muslims in China. One is the Uyghurs, and one is the ethnically Chinese Muslims who are called the Hui.
Uh-huh. And did they speak Arabic? Are using
people
Arabic.
Studied, yeah, they okay. learned, studied like Arabic in school, but not a lot of people, not a lot of people speaking it very well. In the 20th century, things changed. People can go to Cairo and study. Not that many do, but some people
do. Right. Slaves were traded.
Yeah.
Along the Silk Road.
There's a lot of...
Tell me about the documentation you found there.
Well, there's contracts for the individual purchase of an individual, of a single purchase of an individual. There's one record in Chinese of a household that has... like two people at the head of it, and then maybe 70 young women and 60 young men. And one of the Chinese historians thinks that it may be a slave-producing household. It's very clear that the minority peoples coming into China, many of them were dancers. Mm-hmm. And so there's kind of a thin line between a dancer and a sex worker and a slave.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And a wife, too, probably.
Uh-huh, uh-huh. So we saw the trade of slave girls.
Yes.
Yeah.
And we have specific instances. We have a Sogdian contract for the purchase of a young girl actually by a Buddhist, which is funny because you think of them as being celibate, and they take vows to be celibate. But anyway...
Never mind slavery.
Never mind. Well, the purchase of people, I guess that is the most basic definition of slavery, but you don't know what's going to happen to the person after they're purchased. They might become like a wife or a concubine. They're often, I think people's sense of Chinese slavery in China is that it's not people working in fields. It's not like the American South. It's often people working in the household. And probably an individual house didn't have that many slaves.
Yeah. And finally, when we think of the Mediterranean Sea, we think of a body of water that connected a number of different civilizations. Could we see the Silk Road in that same way? I mean, obviously not a body of water.
Like a body of sand.
Yeah.
The Buddhists, there's an early metaphor about the Buddha leading people through the desert like someone leading a ship through water. Huh. And I think certainly in that region around the Taklamakan Desert, there are oases and people are traveling from one oasis to another, very much like going from one port to another. So it is a cultural region in the Mediterranean. Well, that's a good question. There are certain languages. I mean, Latin and Greek will take you pretty much anywhere. You could probably get pretty far with Sanskrit or Sogdian or Chinese. Yeah, I think it's a good example. There were a lot of, in any given Mediterranean port, people would be speaking their own languages as well, and that was certainly mm-hmm. true on the Silk Road, that there's this whole host of languages, many of them dead now, that people were speaking.
And as you were saying, many languages have influenced other languages.
Right, yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. Valerie Hansen, thank you for being here.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you so much.
Again, Valerie Hansen has been our guest, professor of history at Yale University, and author of the new book, The Silk Road, A New History.